In Some Mother's Son.
The menu kite has to be perfection, do you understand?
Perfectly, Mr. Julian, sir.
I think we'll spring some nouvelle cuisine on our colonial friend, disorientate him. Buy some of those big coloured Italian plates they've got at the design centre, you know the ones.
Yes, sir.
The food must be arranged in exact geometric pattern over them. That should get him wondering. Serve Chateau Pretrou 64 with the meal, exact room temperature.
Of course.
The service kite must be immaculate. Every gesture, every presentation so precise, so inevitable that it seems preordained. The second that oaf enters my room with his hail fellow well-met Masonic handshakes and hints about knighthoods under the counter in the honors list, he must see, his instinct must tell him immediately, he can do nothing else but give way to my demands. Ritual kite has its function.
I'll see to the menu, Mr. Knight.
And in half an hour, I want a conference with my clothes designer. Ambiance is all.
I'll phone her.
Only 2 days till Thursday. Know my problem, kite?
Mr. Julian?
I relish perfection. I enjoy it too much. I am a glutton for perfection.
Get the meat out of the freezer.
Sir Jack?
The carcass of that wildebeest we shot last week. It should just about have defrozen by the time we land at Heathrow.
Sir Jack, what...
We won't take the jet. This is quite a mundane piece of business we're about to transact. We don't want anyone to get the message we might think it anything else. Get a couple of seats on the evening jumbo to London. Book a helicopter to fly us to Mr. Knight's penthouse when we get there.
And the wildebeest?
The company jet. We can use it for him. Don't let the thought of those baggage handlers at Heathrow mauling him out of the belly of a 747. He must be inviolate.
Oh, Sir Jack, surely
you don't understand, do you, Grey? The moment of slaughter is vital. The slain must be treated with the greatest of respect or reverence. Their carcass is cut apart, filleted only by those who care.
The moment of slaughter?
You never went hunting with tribesmen when you were a bare-kneed boy. This wildebeest was hunted to exhaustion. Its heart beat like thunder. Every muscle and blood vessel arched and strained. Every organ had pumped itself to oblivion. The flesh of such a creature, killed at such a moment, is at its tenderest and most sweet. To be savored. Worthy of a feast of victory. That is why we take it to little pretty boy's penthouse. To light a barbecue, whose flames will be seen all over London.
He's after me like a great-jawed greyhound hunting a hare, snapping and sliding every time I twist and turn, all the time looming up and over. A nightmare of streets and intersections unreels, careering cars, smoking lorries, shouting pedestrians. My lungs have rotted all away. My calves are jelly and my heart a pea squeaking and rattling between my ribs. And still I force on, across the river, into West London. My beautiful Claude Butler never for a second failing or hesitating. At last, under the benevolent gaze of two scowling traffic cops in their Rover, by the traffic lights where the Westway plummets into Marylebone Road, four buttressed lanes of flying motorway descending en masse into central London, I can rest a second. And think. He idles 50 yards behind me on his motorbike, revving it occasionally. Westway down pours its foul load of fat lorries and squat vans right before me. If between the amber and green, I were to shoot the lights and the crossing traffic and plunge straight up into that wall of descending traffic, face to face, headlight to headlamp, dodging and dancing like a gnat under charging elephants, then... In theory, fine. In practice, great oncoming cliffs blocking out the sun. Never has she responded quicker, more lightly and delightfully. And I'm thin, between the walls of containers and cargoes, I can dodge and flick. 100, 200, 300 yards. And then it cracks, gives, starts to retreat into the waiting arms of the police. What do? Crammed into the curb. An eternity of 3 miles against the flow to the next traffic entrance. I look over the side. A leap of 8 feet across a chasm to a factory roof. All I must leave behind me is my white saviour. My beautiful white Claude Butler. I touch her handlebars a final time. Then jump.
Yes?
Shirley.
What are you doing here, Anne?
Well,
this is Monday. You're not meant to be here till Tuesday.
I need help.
Deirdre's asleep in the bedroom.
Then can I just tiptoe in and sit in the kitchen and munch on some cornflakes and try to pull myself together? I swear I won't wake her. I need shelter.
Well...
I'm desperate, Shirley. Please, some cornflakes, some human company.
So there I was, halfway up Westway, and I had to make this leap. This man was right behind me on the motorbike, and I...
Me and the sisters have been discussing this. Toys.
Toys?
Yeah. It all goes back to when you men were little boys and you were allowed, by the ignorant patriarchal values that then existed, to have toys. Violent toys. Soldiers, guns, tanks. Kill, kill, kill. So, while you're all having these violent fantasies aged 4, you're laying them down. And when you become adults, then all you men are doomed to take them out and relive them, unwind them out of your psyches, on the poor and the defenceless.
So, you think everything I've just been saying is fantasy?
Male fantasy. Now, finish your cornflakes.
Thank God I've still got cornflakes. Good old reliable fast foods, pumping me up with additives and enzymes and tranquilizers till I float out bloated and happy into that great big chemical refinery in the sky. Oh, mother.
What's that noise? Not someone else at the front door.
Hope it isn't someone for me.
It better not be. Deirdre doesn't like being woken up by anyone, let alone men.
I think I might be leaving by the back window.
It has woken Deirdre. She's answering the door.
Oh, God, it is them. They've attacked Deirdre. Oh!
Attack Deirdre? Men don't attack Deirdre. Listen to her. She's got a black belt in karate.
Oh.
She's demolishing him. Go on, Deirdre. Atta girl. Oh, God. I wish the women's video lab was here to film this. A violent man getting his just desserts. We'll be able to show it at our therapy sessions.
I'm afraid I'm leaving by the back window.
Lovely men.
I'll try and be more macho next time. After a desperate encounter with Shirley's dustbins, I make my getaway, fling myself upon a number 37 bus, which promptly sits in a traffic jam for 10 minutes. But my pursuer is fully occupied with the delightful Deirdre. Eventually, we lurch and lumber southward. After the swift, fierce beauty of my white bike, this is a rogue and peasant way to travel. Before his death, Birmingham had scrawled on a scrap of paper a number, a code. I need access to a computer terminal, one I can plug anonymously into a phone line and get to work with.
Here we are. Display, keyboard, disk drive, all the other computer knobs and twiddles we electronic illiterates know nothing about.
Great.
Some fly-by-night computer firm gave it all free to me about 18 months ago. I was going to give them a puff in my column only they went bust first.
So here in your back room it gathers dust.
Nothing ages faster than yesterday's market leader. Looks positively ancient now. Bye.
You going?
My column calls. I have to interview the ageing but perfectly formed Sandra Durbin.
Oh, that film actress, you mean. Bit temperamental, isn't she?
Not with me. If she starts getting out of line, I'll just tell her I'm going to write an entire column listing her varicose veins one by one. 3 operations she's had and her legs still look like willow pattern china.
The popular image of the computer hacker is of one man heroically bashing away at his ivories, single-handedly breaking the code and gaining access to a system. It isn't really like that. Like all the best things, essentially it's a group effort. In his lonely way, a hacker is gregarious. He and other like-minded Robin Hoods and Jolly Rogers have common roosts, unofficial software pools, secret areas annexed within the vast programs of company computers where they might list and swap information, gaggle, gossip and talk shop. An electronic notice board.
Bravo, the rat suggests you can get into CompuLine on dial-up at 300/300 or on 251-6180. No, I don't have passwords. Speed Infinity of Croydon suggests you get into Intercompany Contrast database of 70,000 companies via their 1200/75 view data front-end processor on 263-8784. Type THUD when asked for your company code.
The Insanatorium, Shepton Mallet, states that British Telecom's recent record profits and continuing appalling service have prompted the circulation of this information. It comprises a method of making telephone calls free of charge.
Yes, friends, beneath our city streets, along country telegraph poles, somewhere in the suburbs, after all respectable people have stopped watching Terry Wogan and gone to bed, birds of an electronic feather lurk together. I pass from electronic notice board to electronic notice board. Cornish Jake, Liverpool Bite, Grimsby Gremlins. Everywhere searching for a hint of Birmingham drizzle. A place he might have concealed his findings.
Here he is. Who? Andrew Smith. Age 39. His photograph.
Andrew Smith.
Included in file, physical description, list of addresses and known habitations. MOCV, etc., etc.
Everything down to the last time he wore nappies.
And here is the other one. Photograph. Nigel Thompson. Another journalist.
Journalists are ponces. Oh, lives in Rickmansworth, according to his file.
One wife, two children.
Rickmansworth.
That's them. That's our couple.
All through the day I searched through electronic cellars and attics, inched through crevices and down chimneys, until at last I uncover a hint, a reference to Midland's downpour. Anyone wishing to inquire further, states the screen, should insert appropriate code. I type it in. Then suddenly, out in front of me, tumbles my complete story. My immense, frightening story. I can understand why they killed Birmingham. Why they want to kill me. I am sitting on top of God.
A checklist listing implements required.
Funny paper it's written on.
It's a printout from a computer. I reckon the outfit that's hiring us is very well off, well organised.
A burial implement?
Oh, they mean a spade. A spade for digging.
Then why can't they call it a bloody spade?
Stanley.
And another thing. If they're that good, why can't they afford decent paper from their computer printouts? I mean, look at this stuff. Cheap and nasty. I wouldn't use it for...
Stanley! All computers print out on paper like this.
Rogers, just because someone is employing you, it doesn't mean you can't sit in judgment on them. Your trouble is you put far too much trust in those putting authority over you. I mean, look at that trouble in the Sudan. Hired by a Yorkshireman. A Yorkshireman with a fly whisk. Go out there, lads, get stuck in, kill a few blacks and I'll see you're not short of a bob or two. Oh, you says he's a Yorkshireman. A Yorkshireman with a fly whisk. He must be honest. Blunt, rude even, but Yorkshiremen are always honest. So, we go out there. Find that blooming Yorkshireman mowing down blacks, whites, you, me, anything that moves. exchanged his fly whisk for a submachine gun. He's a raving psychotic.
Stanley.
So I am warning you, Rogers. This lot might have super-efficient computer printout lists and what have you, but anyone who calls a spade a burial implement qualifies in my book for the higher realms of Wallydom. Rank Wallydom. And should be watched accordingly.
Birmingham had done his final job beautifully. Delved right into the heart of AFCO's dark empire. Uranium, politics. Nothing simpler. Nothing nastier. Colonel Saeed possesses Tambia. Tambia possesses half the Western world's uranium reserves. Blackjack Watson wants a monopoly on those reserves, while Colonel Saeed wants his very own nuclear bomb to further the cause of Muslim fundamentalism. The Middle East and North African cocktail would suddenly go nuclear. So would every terrorist suitcase. If Blackjack wants his uranium monopoly, he can take some of it to England, get it processed using whatever means are necessary, and return it to Colonel Saeed. This whole process is detailed in internal AFCO memos and directives split open by Birmingham. The organisation of the robbery, to hide the fact it was uranium, the metal's secret addition to an official enrichment process, its secret subtraction once that process had been completed, its imminent export as ballast, all programmed, all detailed, all passing out of my word processor. Before I start to write my article, the greatest scoop I've ever had, I must check one final detail.
Anne.
Home.
We've got to go.
What?
Vamoose. We'll use your Porsche.
Don't you want to hear about Sandra Durbin? The truth? Oh, she hasn't got varicose vein. She's got her...
Come on, come on. My scoop has come.
Oh, I do like London's docks these days. Filled with bright young people in video and PR and electronic publishing. Look at it. Bursting with venture capital. Transformed.
Yeah, the traffic's as bad as ever it was, though. Come on. We've got to be at Tilbury for a 3 o'clock sailing.
I'm afraid that even Porsches are not designed to overcome London traffic.
Oh, Claude Butler racing bikes are, though. Cut through this lot like Murdoch through print workers.
Andy?
Yeah?
From what you were able to find out through AFCO's internal documents, why is Blackjack so keen on buying out Julian Knight?
Propaganda, mainly. I wasn't able to spend too much time on that side of things. But it looks from his memos that Watson mainly wants Natural as a way into Fleet Street. So if things get sticky in the future over his relationship with Saeed, at least he'll have a few independent commentators on his side. Look, that lorry's moving. Get in behind it.
Right. But you're sure that all this AFCO stuff you found is genuine?
What do you mean?
Well, in the old days, before all this electronic stuff, it was people you could go and check out. They'd have a story. You'd at least be able to form an impression of whether they were telling you the truth. But nowadays...
Nowadays?
Well, you broke into that computer. Who says someone else couldn't have before you to plant the information for you to find? You're going to be making an awful lot of accusations in your article.
There's one way of checking, Anne. That's why we're going to Tilbury. You, me, and my Geiger counter.
In the end, by 5 minutes, the traffic beat us. We roared through the huge gates, sped through the nearly empty docks, vast acres of grey, windswept concrete, to the berth where the ship should have been. She was 50 yards from the dockside, the tugs churning the water white as she moved unerring for the Thames and the wide ocean beyond. AFCO's flag hung cheekily over her stern. And over the side, in a group of 3 or 4, lounged the young man I'd last seen knife-drawn in Birmingham's attic. Beside him stood the telephone engineer I'd seen tapping my phone. Another one still bore Deirdre's scars and bruises. And they all saw me and waved, jeering.
They know you.
All safely bound for Tambia. Missed them by 5 minutes.
I'm not quite sure.
It doesn't matter, though. Now, where do you think the cargo was likely to have been on the dockside before they winched it aboard?
By this crane, I suppose.
Yeah.
Why?
Why? That's for why. This Geiger counter is the proof of my article. Listen to it. Almost off the end of the dial. Weapons-grade uranium rested here not more than an hour ago.
This it?
Final draft, yeah.
So Jack Watson must therefore answer the question. If the refined uranium was not meant for the bombs of Colonel Sahid, who precisely was it meant for? For too long, this maverick backwoodsman, consorting with unsavoury dictators in the Third World, exploiting his labour mercilessly, has been able to ride roughshod over civilised, decent values. Now, however, it appears he has gone too far. An explanation is required.
Like it?
An explanation is required. Stirring stuff. You've used all their memo stuff cleverly, too.
I'll be sending complete copies of the internal AFCO documentation with every copy of the article.
Sending copy? Aren't you printing it in Green Times?
Green Times? This story is far too important for Green Times. Besides, it's a month, if ever, before the next edition. I'm sending copies to journalists on The Times, The Guardian, Financial Times, New Scientist and New Statesman. Also three or four politicians.
But you'll lose your scoop.
Nuclear weapons are a bit too important for that.
I don't know.
The story's got to hit the streets immediately. I'm sure your Julian Knight will be more than a little interested in it. But anyhow, I expect my name will get mentioned occasionally, here
but
and there.
Andy, you're made. This is your great chance to... Damn. Hello? Oh, Nigel. Yes, he is. Hang on. It's Nigel Thompson phoning from Rickmansworth. Sounds like he's read your story already.
Thanks. Nigel? Yeah? Yes? Oh, I see. I'll be with you right away.
What's happening?
I've got to go. The stat machine's knocking out copies. Can you put one in each envelope? I've addressed them, plus the documentation, and drop them in at a post office. Send them registered.
I'll do better. Take them round, deliver each one by hand.
This should be the happiest day of my life. Scoop Smith. I sit on the Baker Street to Rickmansworth train, all stainless steel and neon, as we jog through the early evening, and I feel melancholy. The success has come, Anne. And what about Shirley? Opposite me sit a family. Mum, Dad, three children, home from shopping. Each alone, yet each tied to all the others with a comfortable bond of tetchy familiarity. A family. What I've missed and always wanted someday with Shirley. What I now probably will never have. Forever to remain solitary. It's a slate grey of dusk as I arrive at Nigel's. No lights. I know his family's away, but at least with him, the front door's open. I go in, my eyes accustoming to the darkness. Nothing. A deserted house. I pass out through the French windows into the back garden, and then, by the wooden table where we'd sat a week ago and made so merry beneath the blazing sun, I discovered a figure, very still.
Nigel?
No response. I hurry over, but I already know what I shall find in the lonely, friendless garden.
Nigel?
Slaughtered. Another mother's son. Coldly exited from this life without grace or ritual.
Good evening.
Evening.
I struggle, more for form's sake than through any deep conviction I might escape.
Don't struggle.
Yeah, stop it.
You know we know you won't escape, so stop it.
Slightly balding, wire-framed spectacles awry, I stand before them, drawn up to my full 5'9".
What do you want?
We'll put him in a potting shed.
I'm in charge here.
Yeah, we'll put him in a potting shed. After we've taken out the burial implement.
Burial implement?
The spade. Clever place to conceal a burial implement, a potting shed.
I'd better phone Mr. Knight.
Mr. Knight?
You Wally, you overweight, underbrained Wally. Why'd you mention that? Look, stick him in the potting shed and get the spade. Graves must be dug. Tomorrow is Thursday.
Tomorrow's Thursday, whatever that means. I spend a cold, cramped night among Nigel's neatly stacked flower pots and rakes and sieves and tomato cases. All the while, outside, I hear my two captors curse and heave as they dig Nigel's grave, where he might have most wanted it, in the midst of his immaculate vegetable garden. Recycling with a vengeance, I crouch and ponder. Mr. Knight, tomorrow's Thursday.
And tomorrow, as Andy Smith discovers who's smuggling uranium, will he escape mortal danger?
On BBC Radio 4 Extra.
I hadn't seen anything like that before, ever.
I'm Harriet Kemsley, and I've invited four phenomenal stand-up comedians to celebrate the trailblazing comics who inspired them.
It was just like, oh, this is what alternative comedy can be.
Who are these women? How can they be this funny? And they got their own TV show.
Featuring Jen Brister, Shazia Mirza, Josie Long, and beginning with Jessica Fosterkew on her hero, Rick Mayall.
He was a big, naughty man.
Comedy Catalysts continues tonight at 10:30 in the Comedy Club on BBC Radio 4 Extra and on BBC Sounds.
Great Lives on BBC Radio 4 Extra.
This week's Great Life is Charles Sargent Jagger, and nominating him, also a sculptor, is Martin Jennings. Our expert witness is Anne Compton. And to say that the war must have changed him as a person is probably an understatement, isn't it?
I think so. I mean, how could one not go through this and not be changed? In later years, he could be very intolerant in a rather unpleasant way of people who had not contributed to the war effort. And he also emerged with quite a cutthroat determination to further his career.
How, Anne, did he get back into sculpting then after the First World War?
Well, he was extraordinarily lucky that through contacts he was appointed as a war artist by the Ministry of Information. Then on top of that, Jagger had actually won just immediately before the start of the First World War and a very important scholarship awarded by the British School at Rome. And the British School at Rome agreed to give him a year's funding to work in London instead of having to go out to Rome. And through